The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Allergic Skin Disorders and HAE is presented by Dr. Timothy Craig.
I have now kind of gone over rhinitis and sinusitis were done. I was going over a little bit of food and drug allergy and then some allergic skin disorders. And remember, they do have dermatologic questions on the boards and recert. So what food allergies do most children now grow? A, peanut and apple. B, wheat and seafood. C, milk and tree nuts. Or D, eggs and milk. And the answer would be D, eggs and milk. Both of them usually outgrown. That's why in adults, eggs and milks aren't as common as peanuts, wheat, and seafood. What vaccine is contraindicated in people with an allergy to egg? And Brian just went through this. I think this is a good question. MMR? Probably not. Tetanus? No. Yellow fever? Influenza, as Brian said? Not really, unless it's really severe. Herpes zoster? No. So the answer here would be yellow fever. There is enough egg antigen in yellow fever that it can be cause anaphylaxis in egg allergic people. So food allergy, pretty common, 2 to 3% of the population, but 20% of the population thinks they have a food allergy. If you look at the 8 foods that are most important, it's peanuts, tree nuts, soy, shellfish, fish, egg, milk, and wheat. As I already said, milk and egg is usually outgrown. Delayed in use of epinephrine can cause death. Very important, if someone needs 2 epinephrine treatments in the emergency room, those are the people who are likely to have a severe delayed reaction, as I talked about before. And then those people should be observed for 6 to 8 hours. Asthmatics are at increased risk of death when they have anaphylaxis. And the way of making a diagnosis is by a good history, occasionally skin testing or in vitro testing. And what you shouldn't be doing are huge panels of food, but only on those foods that are suspected. The treatment is obviously avoidance and epinephrine for all kinds of anaphylaxis. Gluten is in milk, nuts, corn, or barley? The answer would be the latter. Milk, obviously not. Nuts, obviously not. And corn, definitely not, even though it is derived from grass like wheat and barley and rye. The answer also could be oats, right? Oats don't have gluten in them. So celiac disease, gluten is the protein and the antigen. Gluten is in wheat, barley, and rye. Serologies used to be poor, but serologies have gotten better. And where we used to do an endoscopy on people while they were on gluten, looking for blunting of the villi, and then withdraw gluten, and then re-scope them, and then reintroduce it and scope them again. Now that's no longer necessary in most cases because the IgA anti-tissue transglutaminase test is about 98% sensitive and about 95% specific. So that's why you would normally get the test if it was positive and the person was an IgA defective, or I should say deficient, then you would move that person on to endoscopy. IgA antibodies to endomycelia used to be the preferred test before transglutaminase, but it is less sensitive. And also, there is a test for IgG and IgA to gliatin, but that's a less sensitive test as well. For dermatitis herpetiformis, they really do say that you should get both tissue transglutaminase as well as endomycelial to increase your sensitivity. And remember, 1 in 500, Brian, I think, said 1 in 600, people are IgA deficient, and thus make sure you check your IgA when you get these tests. So this is the way you used to make the diagnosis, by biopsy, where you get villi atrophy in those people who have gluten sensitivity. But again, transglutaminase is a good enough assay in sensitivity to exclude most cases. So Peter is a 40-year-old white male from Finland. He presents with papules, blisters, and sores on his elbows and buttocks that are extremely itchy and sometimes painful. Otherwise, he's in good health and he's not taking any medications. This is his rash, and if you see this rash, you should be thinking about one thing. So what test would you obtain to help diagnose it? Would you get a chest x-ray, abdominal flat plate, a skin biopsy, or a skin scraping? Come on now. It'd be skin biopsy, right? You could also do serologies to help. But as I said, serologies are really good for gluten enteropathy, not as good for dermatitis epidermidis. So this is typical of what you would see. You would see IgA deposited along the epidermis, dermis junction. So your patient has dermatitis epidermidis, what would you treat them with? Doxycycline, penicillin, Plaquenil, or Dapsone? So I think you all should know that. It'd be Dapsone. Brown spider bites and dermatitis epidermidis are the two things that Dapsone is prescribed for. So you treat gluten enteropathy, both of them, and dermatitis epidermidis with no exposure to wheat, barley, or rye. Even trace levels of any of these can cause exacerbation of the symptoms. And for the rash, the drug of choice is Dapsone. So Maria is a 21-year-old female. Since 13, she's had 6 or more episodes of swelling of her limbs and face. Her episodes last about 3 days. She has recurrent abdominal pain as well, sometimes with swelling, sometimes without swelling. She's never had urticaria or signs of anaphylaxis. She's been treated aggressively in emergency rooms with antihistamines and steroids, and they really don't seem to make a difference. This is what her hands look like when she swells. So what test would you perform to help in a diagnosis? Would it be a CH50? Would it be C1 esterase inhibitor? Would it be a C3? A C4, or bradykinin. So this is actually on my boards too, but you know, there's been 3 articles alone this month in the New England Journal of Medicine on hereditary angioedema, so you better be prepared to see questions on it. Actually, even in first year board school tests for medical students, they were on. So the answer here would be C4. So let's walk through those distractors. Well, CH50, great test if you're looking at total complement deficiency. For what Brian talked about, immunodeficiencies, it would be the best screening test. C1 esterase inhibitor, that is low in type 1, but remember you would miss 15% of those people, that is those with type 2. C3, that's more for lupus. Bradykinin, it's too short-lived to really use in an assay, so the answer here would be C4, which would be the exclusion for hereditary angioedema. And this is a table showing type 1, accounts for the majority of hereditary angioedema, 85%. They have low C4, low protein, and low function. This protein is made but doesn't fold correct, so it's not secreted. Since the protein's low, the function is low, and then C4 gets consumed, and that's why it's a good screening test. Type 2 hereditary angioedema accounts for 15%. They have a low C4, but they have a normal or even high C1 inhibitor level, so you would have missed them if you just got the C1 inhibitor level, right? But their functional level is low because the enzymatic head's dysfunctional. Type 3 is very rare, and I doubt you'll ever have a question on it. So if we go back to our patient here, she has a bunch of attributes that make you think of hereditary angioedema. She has abdominal pain, less than 3 days. She has swelling, less than 3 days. She's never had hives. That should make you think about hereditary angioedema. And she's refractory to antihistamines and corticosteroids because people with hereditary angioedema need more aggressive medications. I'm going to pass to them. So hot points in the complement system, Brian talked about them. C4 is for hereditary angioedema. C1 is how you differentiate acquired angioedema from hereditary angioedema. C50 is for the classical complement, looking for immunodeficiencies. C3 for active lupus, the terminal component because of the risk for Neisseria meningitis as well as gonorrhea. C2 is the most common complement defect. And then a little about PNH. Remember, the CD55 and CD59 are defective here. So C3B and C4B bind to red cells on a regular basis. It's only because of CD55 and 59 that take off that complement and inactivate it. And thus, if you want to prevent PNH, you would have an antibody against CD55, and there is one now. Which drug should not be used in hereditary angioedema? Progesterone, C1 esterase inhibitor, aspirin, or lisinopril. So the swelling of ACE inhibitors is secondary to what? To bradykinin, right? And what they have is failure to catabolize bradykinin. So if someone's having overproduction, as with HAE, you obviously would never want to use an ACE inhibitor in these individuals. Plus, estrogen increases exacerbations, so that would be the other drug you'd want to avoid. In turn, androgens benefit these people. So just kind of looking at drugs to avoid in allergic diseases. So non-selective beta blockers, probably not best to use in asthma, or in anaphylaxis, or in COPD, nor in people who you're going to skin test or use immunotherapy. ACE inhibitors, because of a cough occurring in 15 to 20%, probably aren't the best drugs to use in asthma. There are some data suggesting that some asthmatics can get hyperreactive or hyperresponsive airways when they take ACE inhibitors, but there's contrary articles as well in the literature. But I would say ACE inhibitors should not be used in asthma because of the cough. Also, you shouldn't use them in hereditary angioedema. Radio contrast, Brian talked about. So if someone has very poorly controlled asthma or congestive heart failure that's uncontrolled, or if they have chronic urticaria, or if they have prior reactions, these are people who probably should not receive contrast material. Also true with mastocytosis. And again, I already mentioned ACE inhibitors and estrogens, both contraindicated in hereditary angioedema. I think, did you cover this, Brian? You talked about it, but I don't know if you talked about testing. Yeah, so the best way to diagnose contrast allergy is A, a challenge, B, skin testing, C, in vitro assay, D would be history, or E would be a history to seafood allergy. So it's, look, challenge, well, probably you don't want to do that. Skin testing, well, it's not IgE mediated, so that doesn't help you. In vitro assay, same reason, there's no IgE, so the best would be a good history. History of seafood allergy has nothing to do with it. It's a protein that causes seafood allergy. It does not, the protein does not cause reactions to contrast. So the answer would be D. So again, I'm not going to go through this because Brian mentioned it. The only thing I'd add to what he didn't is the repeat contrast after someone has a reaction. You have about 35% chance of having it. If you pre-medicate them, they decrease it down to 10. If you use a low contrast agent, decrease it down to 1. And then if you use both together, the pre-treatment plus the low contrast, you get down into the fractions. So treatment, Brian already went through this, so I'm going to skip it. I think I'm going to skip it. Okay. So your patient has multiple drug allergies. Which test would you refer her to exclude an allergic reaction? An immunocap for penicillin, skin testing for doxycycline, skin testing for penicillin, an immunocap for cephalosporins, or skin testing for cephalosporins? So the answer would be skin testing for penicillin if they were penicillin allergic, right? There is no immunocap for penicillin allergy. Doxycycline you can't skin test for. when I was young and stupid, I did skin test somebody and they had a bad reaction. I skin tested myself. It's too irritant to use for a skin test. ImmunoCAP for cephalosporins, a skin testing for cephalosporins, there's not a test. So the only answer here could be skin testing for penicillin. Unfortunately, we're very limited by having that as our only really good skin test that has defined sensitivity and specificity. So drug reactions, allergic. Remember, most are haptens that bind to proteins or macromolecules. Fatal reactions, more likely to IV than with IM. And very rarely can you kill someone with an oral medication. Sensitization, topical, highly sensitive, IV greatest, oral least. Treatment of choice, obviously to avoid the medication, or if you need it, to desensitize. And again, with penicillin, if they have a history of penicillin, remember about 20% of people say they're allergic to penicillin, and it probably really only goes down to about 1% to 2%. So skin testing is really a good, reliable way of defining whether or not someone has a penicillin allergy. So those are the numbers I talked about. I was a little off. About 18% say they're allergic. 4% of people without a history of penicillin allergy will actually be allergic. If you are allergic by history, skin testing works very well. Decreases the risk of reintroduction of penicillin from 60% to 4%. So it's worthwhile. Remember, estrianon, imipenem do not really cross-react with penicillin. Imipenem does cross-react, so they should be skin tested in that time too. And there's a lot of good literature out there saying that you decrease the duration in the ICU, decrease hospitalizations, decrease cost of medicine, of as well as it's good shepherd, what was it, shepherdness or whatever, a good utilization of antibiotics to define whether or not someone is allergic to penicillin. Even though we all use human-derived insulin, just because of tertiary structure changes, you can still have an allergy to insulin. The idea is not to stop it, decrease the dose to reduce those symptoms, gradually build it back up. You can desensitize if necessary. Sometimes just a period of time on steroids as well as antihistamines can lead to decreased risk of having reactions and allow the patient to tolerate it again. If your person's allergic to sulfur antibiotics, allergy, or they're allergic to sulfur antibiotics, what drugs should they avoid? Should they avoid Lasix, thiazides, sulfureas, Dapsone, or sulfasalazine? This is a really good question, I think. The answer is E. There's literature out there that sulfonamides or sulfur antibiotics did not cross-react with diuretics, nor diabetic sulfureas, and don't with Dapsone, but do with sulfasalazine. So again, probably to avoid that if a person has a sulfur allergy. So sulfur allergies, about 5% of hospitalized people will say they have it, 10 times more risk in HIV people, maybe mainly because their increased risk of allergic disease as well as increased exposure to sulfur drugs. You can desensitize people, but there is really no good skin test, nor a blood test, unfortunately. And again, there's no evidence they cross-react with diuretics, nor with sulfureas or Dapsone. So with drug allergies, treatment of choice is best to avoid those drugs you suspect. Replace them with other drugs if you think it is drug-related. If you can't do that and a person needs a drug, desensitization is probably a good way of going about it. But remember, never challenge people who have any of the severe skin disorders such as TENS, Steven Johnson's, or Dress syndrome. That's a total contraindication. So your patient is on Tegretol and has increase in eosinophils on CBC and a maculopapular lash, what diagnosis would you consider? A, erythema multiforme, B, DRESS, C, hypereosinophilic syndrome, or D, immediate hypersensitivity. So if you look at the difference, the distractus here, erythema multiforme's kind of out here, right? because you usually don't see eosinophils. Hypereosinophilic syndrome, it could be, right? But that's only usually used if you can't explain it any other way. It's a diagnosis of exclusion. Immediate hypersensitivity, well, you would think more urticaria or angioedema. Not always, but those are the skin changes you usually expect. So it would leave you with with DRESS syndrome. And this is the typical rash of DRESS. It's a maculopapule rash, usually kind of non-defined. And DRESS syndrome is drug rash with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. Often they get rash, sometimes high. High fevers. They get the increased eosinophils, and often they will go on to have hepatitis as well as pneumonitis. It often follows drug introduction by 2 to 6 weeks, but on reintroduction, the symptoms can occur in a day or two. Remember, with the seizure medications, phenytoin, tegretol, and phenobarbital all cross-react, and if you have a reaction to one, you shouldn't introduce the others. It may be fatal, and I remember testifying for a doctor in a case where they had tegretol on, and they kept on watching the eosinophils go higher and higher, and they noted that the person was getting worse and worse, but they never stopped it. Eventually, the lady died, and it was a hard case to defend. And remember, never introduce that same drug in the future if you diagnose DRESS syndrome. Most of us feel steroids are beneficial because the hypereosinophilia, which decreases with the introduction of the steroids. We already talked a little about IgA deficiency, pretty common, 1 in 500. You didn't mention anything about blood transfusions, I don't think. So there could be a risk of, if someone has complete absence of IgA, and you give them a transfusion with IgA, they could have anaphylaxis, and that's often a test. But also you can have low IgA just from drugs, and there's a list of drugs here, sulfasalazine, penicillamine, gold, tegretol, phenytoin, hydroxychloroquine, all can cause a decrease in IgA. You withdraw the drug and it corrects. A patient of yours who's 26 years old with spina bifida needs another surgery. What allergy would you be concerned about? A, penicillin, B, iodine, C, latex, D, egg allergen and anesthetic agents, such as propofol, or E, radio contrast. Well, this would be C. So there's only a couple populations that are really still worrisome with latex allergy. Obviously, we've cleaned up latex pretty well. You're not seeing the increased cases that we did 10 or 20 years ago. But there are a lot of spina bifida people who became sensitized way back when, and you still have to be cautious with this population. So the ones that you worry about are spina bifida, those who have recurrent urologic diseases where they had multiple catheterizations. Some healthcare workers, even though I rarely see that in this day and age, and some rubber workers, that's rubber like tires, not condoms. Rubber additives, or the preservatives in rubber, is what causes contact dermatitis or contact allergic dermatitis. Latex protein usually causes anaphylaxis and IgE-mediated symptoms like rhinitis, hives, asthma, and anaphylaxis. It's the airborne powder on gloves with the latex attached to it that's the problem with inhalation, or the direct contact from a surgical procedure. And if you have a latex allergy, you need to have complete latex-free surgery. If you're a worker, such as a nurse, everybody around you should, if they are going to use latex, it has to be without powder, and you should never use latex gloves, obviously. In most hospitals, though, they've done away with latex totally, but we still have latex in our hospital, and I think most would if you look hard enough. Anybody who's latex allergy should always carry an EpiPen to the doctor's office as well as to a dentist's office. So serum sickness, pretty common. You know, we see it pretty regularly in hospitals right now. We get consulted pretty regularly. So usually it occurs 10 days to 2 weeks into therapy. People get fever, adenopathy, rash, sometimes splenomegaly. It is an immune complex reaction. It's type 3 of the Gellman-Klun's hypersensitivity that I showed you. You see it with a variety of medications, most commonly nowadays with penicillin-derived drugs or sulfonamide drugs. There is some data that if you give antihistamines during it, that you can decrease the severity because it is the release of histamine that allows the immune complexes to deposit. The best treatment, though, in most cases is steroids and also non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And there is an increased risk of an IgE-mediated reaction. So most people would say if you have serum sickness, you should avoid that drug in the future. This is a common question. So what you see here, Brian went into this with vaccines a little, but if you look here, here's a foreign protein, say, used to be horse serum when we used to use that in humans. You would give that for like a snake bite. You would see the protein would be up immediately. And then as the protein started coming down, you would start an increase of IgG. And right at that slight antigen excess is when immune complex would develop and continue developing as long as there's about equal antigen and antibody. And then you see the antibody go up and immune complexes decrease. That's why it takes about 6 to 8 days to get to that point when you introduce the drug. And they often ask that, the question would be, when do immune complex form? It would be in either slight antigen excess or an equivalence of the antigen and antibody. So skin testing is indicated for which reaction from a bee sting? A, hives before age 17. B, a large local reaction crossing two joints. C, hives in an adult. Or D, nausea and vomiting and following 50 stings. So the answer would be C. So if you have only skin changes from bee sting under the age of 17, you don't have to be skin test nor desensitized. If you have large local reactions, if you're a beekeeper, you may get desensitized so you don't have large local reactions, but that in itself is not an indication for skin testing nor desensitization. Nausea and vomiting after 50 stings probably represents a toxic reaction, even though you're at an increased risk of getting an IgE in the future. That would not necessarily be an indication for testing nor desensitization. But hives in an adult, as the only manifestation of an allergic reaction, is an indication for skin testing and desensitization, even though I'd question that, and there's some data out there questioning, as of now, it still stands in the guidelines as a reason to skin test. So insect allergy affects about 1 to 2% of the population between bees and fire ants. 60% of people will have symptoms on re-sting. Skin testing is effective, and those people have adults who have skin changes or greater, and skin testing is considered both sensitive and specific. However, it does miss some individuals, so it's thought that skin testing plus an IgE in vitro test is necessary to totally exclude the disease. If you're not desensitized, your risk, as I said, is about 60% of having a reaction on re-sting. With desensitization, you decrease that risk down to about 4%. The treatment of choice is avoidance, EpiPen, and desensitization. So your patient has a fall-on rash, which should be treated more aggressively with, or should be treated most aggressively with, topical antibiotics, oral corticosteroids, oral steroids, Dapsone, or an antiviral agent. So this is the skin rash. You should look at the distribution and know the diagnosis. So the answer here would be B, would be topical steroids. Topical antibiotics would not be necessary. Oral steroids, probably an overkill. Dapsone, no, it's the extensor surfaces that is dermatitis herpetiformis, not the flexure surfaces, and an antiviral is not indicated here, so the answer would be B. So remember, on children, the face and the body, as you get older, it becomes more extensive surfaces and atopic dermatitis. Also the hands frequently, but remember, irritant dermatitis, more common than contact dermatitis, and more common than atopic dermatitis is affecting the hands. And you can get diffuse severe atopic dermatitis as well. So atopic dermatitis, again, flexure areas, hands. If people have severe exacerbations, think staph infections or herpes. 30% will have food allergies, but if you do a random panel or in vitro panel, you'll find a lot of false positives. They do have decreased energy, or I should say they have increased energy and decreased T1 helper cell responses to the skin, so they are susceptible to infections, both from herpes as well as bacteria. And the big thing that's been in the New England on multiple occasions over the last 5 years is filaggrin. If you have a defect in that, you're more likely to become allergic and also to develop atopic dermatitis. Treatment of choice is lubricants, topical steroids, and then there's also a couple non-steroidals, but they really, I think, much, much too expensive and probably are rarely needed unless you're looking at facial lesions or facial atopic dermatitis. So this is the typical thing, herpes simplex, because the T helper 1 defect in those people who have atopic dermatitis. So just a couple words about topical steroids. Can cause atrophy, telectasias, striae, perioral dermatitis, and that's why the topical, especially high potency, should be avoided on the face. And that's why there's immune modulators that are non-steroidal. That's probably the only indication for them now. There is some thought that there's risk of long-term use, very high doses, that there may be an increased risk of lymphoma. I think that's more kind of theory and really has not been seen in practical cases. So I think this will be my last one. So everybody should be able to look at this and know exactly what the diagnosis is. And the test for this would be patch testing, delayed hypersensitivity intradermal skin testing, IgE-mediated skin testing, or no testing is effective. That the answer would be obviously patch testing. Remember allergic contact dermatitis, type 4 reaction. The most common are nickel, rubber additives, thimerosal, benzocaine, neomycin, topical doxepin. And the treatment of choice is avoidance, if you need it, steroids, topical, and in severe cases, especially such as ruse or poison ivy, you may need 2 weeks of prednisone. This is the typical how you test them is patch testing, where you look for this type of change, erythema and vesicles, and that would be diagnostic on patch testing for allergic contact dermatitis.